So welcome, everyone. This is our sixth and final talk, although we'll have another class for next week in the discussion from this talk. But this is our sixth and final talk on the shadow. This one is going to go into some new ground, but as well as that, I'm going to try to reinforce what we've already been said, what we've already said, and then try to sum up a certain way that we can look for the shadow to be operating within us. And I hope that people have appreciated this take on the Dharma. I find the more contemporary way we can find and hold the Dharma, and the Buddha, by the way, encouraged that. He said very distinctly that people should talk about it in their own language from whatever part of the world they come to, using their own idioms. So I feel like that's what we're doing when we take a subject, instead of just reciting classical text, we bring it into a different form, a different way, a different idiom of our time. And I think the shadow does just that. You don't find it in the literature. And I want to, at the same time, appreciate how difficult it is to understand, not only understand, but to get a clear insight into where it is that we're pointing. I was just back from IMS, and one of our talks in this series, The Formation of Boundaries, didn't take, so I offered it at IMS. And I did it out of sequence. I mean, I didn't do the first two or three talks. I just did that talk. And there was a great deal of confusion from the retreatants. They misinterpreted it as being, boundarylessness is not something that this culture very readily takes to. In fact, we are very self-reliant, and we shore up our boundaries. And especially if we've had a history in which we have given away ourselves or given away our empowerment, there can be a reaction to any sense that boundary, freeing ourselves from boundaries, is a good thing at all. And so there was a confusion along those lines, but that's not what we're talking about at all. It's not the ability to say no or to set limits or to keep your own coordinates very separate from someone else's. That's what we're reinforcing here. But where we're in conflict, looking at where the self is formed, not your integrity, and where we have arbitrarily created a distance between ourselves and our own bodies and our own minds and the rest of the world, it's worth looking into that, I would hope, for all of us. And to get a sense of the strategies the self uses to form its shadow side. Its shadow side is its demarcation, is its own manifestation. The sense of self doesn't arise until there is a shadow and a delineation, a demarcation, a boundary, a border, or whatever way we want to say it. And so we have to understand that and to release ourselves from that kind of tension and constriction and contraction is not what we're talking about in the psychological realm of being able to say no or to hold yourself firm against losing or giving yourself away in the psychological world. So I hope people understand that. I would like to start tonight's talk, which is on the shadow and fear. Now we're really looking at the same thing when we're pulling these parts out, but each time you get a different hit, a different sense of how the shadow is formed through reaction, through fear, through story, and through boundary formation. And they may give you deeper insights into how it's formed, even though essentially fear is the reason we form boundaries. Fear is the reason we react. Fear is the reason that we get attached to our story and perpetuate it. So it's at the basis of most of what we have talked about in the five preceding talks. But I'd like to read a quote from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, if I could. "If only it were so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his or her own heart?" So I hope we see this, that as we go in to these subjects and kind of round it off here after the sixth talk, that we're not talking about a class of people that have shadows other than ourselves. That we're not pointing fingers moralistically at a group that we hold in contempt. That shadow is in each one of us. And that the range in the continuum of what we call good and bad is in each one of us. It was equally in Mother Teresa as it is in you. And we may have conditioned certain reactions towards one side of the polar opposite or the other, but that in no way says that the entire continuum isn't within us. Now, we need to relax a little with that. In fact, I noticed a Christian quote that Jesus said, I thought was right from this talk series. He said, "Resist not evil." I'm not sure how Christians who don't understand formation of self hold that, but that's what he's saying. Resist not evil. Why wouldn't I resist evil? I mean, if we only know contempt for the other side of the continuum, of course we're going to resist evil. He didn't say do evil. He said just don't resist it. And what he's saying then is that let's stop identifying with a certain part of this continuum as being me and my image. Because we'll never live up, first of all, we'll never live up to our own standard. And second, we would create the very war and antagonistic foe that creates our self-embitterment. And we are separating ourselves all arbitrarily from the whole continuum, from this sense of wholeness. And perhaps most poignantly, from love. Love isn't at odds with anything. It's only the self that creates these divisions. The self manifests by creating its divisions. And then, once it's created that tension, that fear, that struggle, it decides it has a problem. Instead of realizing that it was the creation of the tension, it was the creation of the line down through the continuum that was the problem, it says the problem is coming from the other side of the continuum, from the evil. And it doesn't let go of boundaries, it shores boundaries up even firmer. Because it doesn't realize what it does as it begins to retract or contract to the very sense of separation that it created. Now, how much sense does that make? Now, it's not good enough for me to say that. We have to each see it for ourselves. We have to each see this. And that's what the homework, hopefully, is beginning the process. Because I can't talk you out of the struggle between your good image and your poor one. No matter what I say, you're going to go home and reaffirm what you want to reaffirm. Until you see this problem clearly, it doesn't resolve itself. Resist not evil. Because why is he saying that? Because the problem is conceptual. The problem is an abstract one. How are we going to resist an abstract problem? Well, if we realize that it's abstract, there's not too much we have to do about it except let go of the concept that created the abstract in the first place, right? It's an abstract one. There is no good and bad. Now, that scares us a little bit because we feel adrift without the polar opposites. What's life about? I have to overcome something. It can feel as if it's taking our usefulness away. Can it? But maybe there's something that comes in when we do let go of that struggle that we can't possibly sense when we're in the middle of that struggle. And the analogy that I'm working with these days, because it just came to me and I like it, and I probably have already used it on you, so I can't remember. Anyway, it's as if we're earthbound and suddenly we have the opportunity to go to the moon. And somebody shows us a landscape of the moon while we're on Earth and encourages us to get into the rocket ship and go. But we look at the landscape and it's gray. And it's powdery, and there isn't a rock band to be found. And it's so why would I want to go there? And he's saying, well, you don't understand. When you get there, it's great. And I say, yeah, well, it doesn't look great to me. And from the abstract, it looks as if the world of wholeness is very desolate, and that the real juice of life comes on Earth here, where I can be in control. But then we muster the courage, get into the rocket ship, and go to the moon. Now, this is somewhat akin to touching the experience of life as opposed to just intellectual understanding of that. Like you touch your breath and you stay there for a moment and you want to go back to the earth of thought. You get the point? The earth of thought is much more enticing, much more enriching, much more colorful, and you can take it places. So, but after a while, from whatever reason, you touch the moon for an extended period of time, you begin to see the powers that you have on the moon that you never thought were possible on the earth. Like you can jump much higher, you can lift much more. You have strength and abilities far beyond the capability of the limited earth. That's essentially the same in the sense that we fear what it means to be whole. And we hear words like love. Well, they're nice words. They sound reasonable. But, you know, what about my iPod? What about my videos? What about, you know, my productivity, my usefulness, and all of that? That seems to melt in the description of the whole. And we can't imagine what it would be to live without it. In fact, we project the worst case scenario. That would be cold, dry, drab, lifeless. We call it empty. We think, well, when something's empty, I go to the store and fill it up. Doesn't sound like something I want. But we have to move into this. We have to have the courage, or you'll never know your potential. And there's no way for me to be able to talk it into you. In fact, I don't even want to do that. I can just hold up a carrot. And I hope you're hungry enough that you'll eat anything, including a carrot. Now, Let me bring in the Buddha here instead of just Christian things. The Buddha talked an awful lot about uplifting the wholesome and not emphasizing the unwholesome. And if from first glance, that can look very much like a good and bad struggle. But the Buddha was not interested in the moralism of further division. He was interested in eliminating the boundaries of truth within truth so that we can perceive truth. And what other way are we going to do that except go to the place that we are creating those boundaries, which is in the unskillful things that we do, and begin to turn those around and release the boundaries and to come into our basic goodness, which is what the landscape of the moon really contains for us. Basic goodness. But it won't be goodness of your own creation. It won't be goodness of your own control. There's the rub. Because most of us only trust the goodness of our influence, of our will. How could the earth of wholeness, the earth of unity, the world of perfect integration, not care for its pieces? Do you not care for your hand? Do you not care for your feet? The toes and fingers? But it requires a relaxation of the rules of the game of control to come back into the relaxed presence of wholeness, of love. And love, remember, is not a continuum. It's not a left side, right side struggle. In fact, love manifests in seeing and being the whole. How could it not be? As long as we're pretending abstractly that we are outside of that whole, trying to get the rest of it to work towards my favor, and damning the rest of reality when it doesn't, we'll never see or feel love. Not the love of wholeness. Because we keep trying to wrestle the problem to us rather than relax and let the thing be in its natural state. So the shadow, that which we have been taught to be, and that which we have taught to avoid, convinces each of us that we have a problem. Now the shadow, that which we want to be as opposed to that which we do not, there's an inherent tension. And we take that tension as being something wrong with us, not due to the very fact that we're creating the separation in the first place. And then we struggle our whole lives to better ourselves, which means that we're creating more tension all along the way through that betterment. Now, when are we going to put that down? You're not going to die doing that. You better not die doing that. That's an awful death. Basic goodness. Not our ideas of goodness. Our ideas of goodness have to create the tension of fear because we can't live up to those ideals. We're not ever good enough. And we don't, because we live in this culture, our unique idiom is our unworthiness, our unique predicament. Very unique to Western culture, as far as I can perceive it. Tibetans don't even understand what we're talking about when we say that. They don't understand it. What do you mean you don't like yourself? What does that mean? Dalai Lama scratched his head and could not understand it. But we understand it, don't we? Every one of us probably do in this room. And because of that, we don't feel worthy of basic goodness. So we look outside of ourselves to join in some form, some community, some cult, some leader, so that we can at least hover around something we think is basically good until he or she inevitably falls, which they will, because their basic goodness doesn't live up to anyone's ideal, especially if they are exploiting, pretending to be that. Then they fall, you get dissatisfied and go look for someone else. So our ideas of goodness create the struggle. You know, when I was a monk, I had this great plan, you know, before I went to Asia about how I was going to practice, and it would all be like the discourses of the Buddha. You know, I'd be out in the jungles and the devas in the trees would save me. But I landed there, and the first thing I did was to see the creatures I was going to have to work with, and I didn't see the devas. They were going to protect me from them. I saw the centipedes that have the bite that could kill a child, the scorpions, the poisonous snakes that were forever on my roof, or at least I thought them to be, when actually it might have been a branch just rubbing against me. And the spiders that were as big as my hand, massive. And I thought, I didn't get into this. I didn't come here for this. I didn't come into this. I did. This is not good. You go. This is what you feel. And you just you start dropping your reservations, or you leave. That's what you have to do. But because this culture is so affluent that it's been able to put such protective boundaries to its reservations, against its reservations, that it's only now, perhaps in this epoch, this time, that we don't have sustaining affluence to be able to keep it all going. And we're going to start seeing the crashing down of some of our control, and it's going to come in, the creatures, mental or physical creatures. It's already coming in. Our gas prices are soaring, etc. It's fear, the fear of that, rather than the actual experience of that, that is the problem. The fear of that, and you can see how controlled we have become as a species through fear. All the government has to do is to flash its yellow light, the orange light, the red light, the terrorist alert lights, or give you, as they just recently did, the top 10 ways that a terrorist would attack the city, and you'll start voting for Social Security reform. Suddenly it looks very appealing to do what an authority figure tells us to do, isn't it? Let's be smarter than that. Not by duct tape. So you see the scale in front of you, you see? You see that when you lean to the left and you want an ice cream that you rate at 5 on the Richter appetite scale, that when you don't have that ice cream, you're going to be yearning at the -5 of the desire scale. And that when you have the ice cream and you're afraid somebody might take it from you, you're going to be afraid at the 5 level of losing it or not getting it. So you begin to see that this whole thing, this scale, is self-created. What makes it a 5 and not a 3? Or what about somebody who doesn't even like ice cream? What if we didn't yearn at all? In fact, when we do yearn, when we do establish the desire, we create the marker, which decides in exactly proportional way how we're going to suffer in its absence. This is what Thomas Merton says. I like this. The more we try to avoid pain, the more we will suffer, because the smaller, less significant things will torture us in proportion to our fear of being hurt. And the more refined our taste, the more we will suffer, because it's going to be proportional. Because along with that refinement of need and greed comes our fear of that being taken away from us. So it just follows us. It just, the shadow just moves right along with our desire system. And we're just forever creating the seeds of our own destruction. And we don't see it. We don't see it. Now, it's interesting, if you just follow me here, as we get a little more subtle dharma, how this whole thing comes through bringing a concept to life, a single word to life. A word is a description of something that separates that thing out from wholeness. When we define something, we cut it away from everything else. There are no things in reality. The mind makes thingness out of reality. To do that, like a cookie cutter, it has to carve a boundary around something. So in order to do that, it has to be separated from. And therefore, there's a tension in maintaining it to be something that it inherently is not. And then, when we do that, fear is the boundary. It says, if you don't watch, I'm going to take this away from you. If you don't maintain the ongoing boundary formation, the cookie cutter of this dough of life, I'm going to take it away from you. Take what away from us? The lamp? It's all dough. So fear begins to invite an antagonism between having and not having. So we can look at fear and we can see shadow formation everywhere. Let me share another subtle dharma point. You know, you hear in the Buddhist terminology, terms, the Buddhist literature, you hear about views and opinions. A view, again, is a perspective. Reality is the sum total of all perspectives. Another way of saying it is that it has no perspective. And therefore, when we select a perspective or a view out of reality, we have to have tension between those or me that have that view and people who don't. And so we have the inevitable war of views and opinions. Now, what's the antidote to this? Because there is one that's really beautiful. And Buddhism, the Buddha says, compassion has no opposite. Love has no opposite. Love has no opposite. Fear sets up the opposite. Fear, singling something out, which is the creation of fear, creates the sense of I. The sense of I then create a story around myself, and the story has a fear component about me and the image I hold and what I need to become and what I haven't yet become. But love has no opposite. Self-love is where we begin to dissolve the need for opposites. Self-love. Self-appreciation. That's why the foundation of this practice, or any spiritual practice worth a salt, not a salt, is self-love. If we don't start there, we heal nothing, because the war is generated on that battlefield. Not only on that battlefield, but that's the beginning of it. That's the all-important first understanding. I'll tell you a ghost story. True. You can believe it or not, doesn't matter to me. I was at IMS when I was in the mid-70s on staff, and we were having a staff retreat, so it was only about 10 or so of us in the building at that time. And after the early morning sitting, I went into the library, which was on the first floor, and laid down on the couch. And the wooden floors were very old and creaky at IMS, and the lights were all on, and I heard the boards creaking in front of me, and I could feel the presence of something. And I was just lying on the couch watching or feeling that, having done about 10 days of sitting or however long the staff retreat was. I wasn't particularly frightened by it. And then I could feel it turn and come towards me. And then I felt something grab hold. It was malicious, not benevolent. Grab me in the sort of solar plexus and start pulling me like that. And I just didn't fight it. I didn't resist it. I felt it become frustrated and give up and then walk back and leave the room. To this day, I don't know why I wasn't freaked out. But I wasn't at the time, and I didn't fight it. And I think it was because of the practice I had done up until that time, and I wasn't frightened for whatever reason. And it wasn't able to get in. And subsequently, I was reading in the Carlo Castaneda books, Don Juan, said that the malevolent forces of the universe sometimes come and attack your solar plexus, and that the warrior puts his hands like that and protects it. Anyway, I didn't know that at the time. But I was protected because I didn't struggle, because I had a sort of a warmth about what was happening. And then I could understand much more clearly why the Buddha would send his monks to the feet of trees. And if they were then attacked by spirits in the literature, he would tell them to offer the spirits metta. Resist not evil. Resist it not. What can it do? Just think for a moment. Doesn't mean you don't protect yourself. You see, now again, you can take this and you can say, what does he mean? You might just let people rob me or kill me or bomb New York City? No. It means mentally creating a vengeance response instead of allowing clarity to take you to appropriate action. One is from fear and the shadow. The other is from love and from unity. And the fear and the shadow and will never understand the benefit of the unity. That's another landscape. It's another planet. It's the moon. It's incomprehensible from the sense of self, because the sense of self only knows the strategy of protecting the very boundaries that's creating its manifestation. It doesn't even realize, we don't even realize that we're doing it, that we're creating ourselves in the tension we hold. We just know that if we don't, we might be run over, or we have other excuses, other rationalizations to maintain that particular fight. We don't trust enough to put down our arms. Rilke says, beauty, or love, he says beauty, is nothing but the beginning of terror, which we still are just able to endure. And we are so awed because it serenely disdains to annihilate us. We're so used to keeping the protective components of self up and running, the ramparts charged, the connection at bay. And our heart yearns for it, because our heart, even though it has to filter through all the fear responses, it still gets through. It gets through in very, it's like filtering light with a prism. It goes off sharply to the right or left, but it still gets through. Some part of it gets through. And so there's a yearning. And what does the self do with the yearning but continue its same strategy? Of trying to be better. Becoming more moralistic. Fighting the evil of life. Creating more tension through its words. The fear of wholeness is the real fear we hold. Love is the zero point. It has no opposite. It doesn't argue. It doesn't obscure. It doesn't struggle. It does just what we say to do in the meditation instructions. Allow, relax, observe. We are on the exploration of uncovering our shadow. That's what we're going to be doing. That's what we have been doing. Various definitions of how we've been doing that, using various metaphors, various words, idioms. But let us be clear that we're not going to create more divisions, not in this community. And then you can begin to see where religious institutions falter. So I want to spend the last 5 minutes or so of this talk talking about a few things that we can do to uncover the shadow kind of in a continuous way. Know the strategies the shadow employs. It employs the strategy that most of us employ in our life. The sense of ambition, the sense of self-betterment, the sense of fear and struggle. And tied to that is all the ways that we hold life to be so rich, the meaning we give it. Reason that we have such a short life here and why we have to keep ourselves under our thumb. So get a sense that this shadow creation is an ongoing energetic response to life, to cut it up. to create its disfigurement through pointing out, abstracting, arguing with. Watch your reactions. They show very firmly where the shadow is entrenched. That's where the battlefield is the most richly fought. The shadow lives within that reactivity. Observe where you feel divided, isolated, contracted, and ask if that is true. Asking the question exposes you to the lunar landscape. It's now up to you to find the beauty of what lies on the moon. Examine your projections, where you give yourself away because you can't hold the emotion or the image that is internally yours, and how you see it in people or in populations, and how the belittling, judging mind maintains that split and division. Here's one. Watch your humor, the areas of where you laugh. Is it at the sake of someone else's stability? Have you ever seen American home videos? That is the most wretched program. Watch what happens in those videos. There's somebody getting hurt, sometimes terribly. And the laughter that comes at the expense of seeing someone else's suffering. Where do we find humor in our life? Be aware of your desire to be good and relax with it. Relax with it. And finally, watch your story. For we are bound to that story in words and deed. And when that story grips us in its abstraction, in its separation, in its division, which a story inevitably does, watch how divisive actions have to come from a story that in itself is divisive. And nurture your heart. Let the heart go. It doesn't need us to bind it. It needs us to release it. Have faith, all of us have faith, that there is a landscape we have yet to know that holds us all with reverence. For to be on that landscape is to know the sacred. And may we all know that sacred. Thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two? So if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to. Yes. Right. The question is, can I give you an example of keeping track of the story? Let me say it this way. Knowing that you're running on a story. A story is past and future. It's in present, really, because the present that we know is laden with past and only is a very obscured present that is sliced between the oppressive past that I've gone through and what I need to do in the future to escape this oppression. And so most of our stories are a book that feels very unwritten, feels very incomplete, very unsatisfied. If we look at our life and we were to die in this moment, many of us in this room would feel very incomplete, unsatisfied, unresolved in that death. Why? Because our story isn't finished. We're finished. It's just our words aren't finished. We haven't said enough. That's what's not finished. What if we just stopped in the middle of a sentence and shut up? But no, shut up. Really shut up. Don't grumble about being cut off in the middle of a sentence, because then you're carrying the story into that as well. We can carry a story anywhere. But many of us don't feel sufficient to stand up and declare ourselves holy, do we? Yet that's our true fact. You end the story, you find the sacred. You maintain the sacred is off whenever the story completes itself, which is when? Which is never. Because the story keeps writing new chapters. Do you ever feel an emotion to be complete? There's always either more you can get of it if it's a good one, or something that you want to eliminate if it's a bad one. And the story of the emotion is really the story we follow. God, I have to resolve my anger. I'm so angry. I'm always so upset. I feel so aggressive. I'm so passive. People just want... It's right? And on and on and on we go. So then we take workshops and we get over our passivity only to find ourselves cynical and bitter, because the resolution of one is the beginning of something else. That's often worse than what we just resolved. You see, at some point, you see, it has to collapse on itself. It can't be written so that you, okay, wow, resolution, okay, ready to die, now I'm ready. Right? No. And what you begin to learn, because many of us in the room don't believe that the story isn't real. We believe it is real. Well, I can show you pictures in my album that show all the bad things that happened. I can show you my mother. See, and we're so convinced that no matter that your mother has been dead 20 years, she's still as real as she ever was because we carry her with us. But what in this moment, where is there anything unholy in this moment if you're not judging it on a scale? Your lust, your anger, your terror. Or do you have to protect yourself from ghosts? Where? What? What? When we come to the resolution of that what, we put it down. You don't put it down and still believe you're somebody. Putting it down is the end of somebody. You don't stuff it. Right? Okay, I'm not going to have a story. I'll stuff it. Now I'm a person without a story. That didn't do any good. You're still miserable. But this time you're not letting yourself even resolve your misery in the way you used to be able to do. So that's no good. It's seeing that our life depends upon the story. Depends upon it. And testing that equation, because we begin to have a greater and greater intimacy, a greater and greater sensing that there's a landscape beyond the story. Yes, it's beautiful, you're a college graduate, you're da-da-da, an engineer or whatever. But there's a landscape beyond the story that it can't touch. Your story can't touch. And the heart feels that. And I can't remember the question that brought this response. So I will ask if there are any other questions. Yes.
This is not a question, but an experience that I had today of fear that was very instructive. I was driving home on the Aurora Bridge, and all of a sudden, and I have a little Prius, and all of a sudden a big SUV, and I was on the lane that's by the edge of the Aurora Bridge, a big SUV veered right into just, and I was paying attention, which was a good thing, and had time to both honk the horn and step on the brake enough to back up enough and for that car to see was about to hit me and move over, and there was a little wave, probably a panic wave from the driver of the SUV who saw it. And as you can imagine, my body was just like a huge, huge experience of fear. And I was feeling really, you know, sitting here, I was feeling really appreciative of several pieces of Buddhist practice that helped me with that moment. One of them was that in the nonviolent communication class that we'd done maybe about a month ago, I sat in a small group where we had a practice of someone telling a story or something, and I sat with a man who talked about being a bicyclist who'd been hit three times.
Will you just remember, I have to summarize your question for this thing. So if you could just make it a little, yeah.
Make it faster.
Yes, please.
Well, okay, so one lesson was that I listened to his story about being a bicyclist that had been hit three times by people on cell phones. And I was somebody that tended to be on a cell phone in their car. And I had learned something from that story, and I had not been on my cell phone since then, which might have saved my life at this moment today because I was paying attention. And the second was reading about the second was experiencing the fear that I felt as soon as that happened, just being in the physical experience of the fear and getting out of the story of how much I hated some SUVs and what a jerk he was. And I also...
The third? I just want to move on if I could.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
No, go ahead. What's your third one?
Well, this end of the second one was remembering the times that I've almost cut off.
Yes.
So feeling connected to him.
Yes.
And the last one was, so there was experiencing fear in my body.
Right.
And remembering the times that I've almost cut off people and just kind of doing that practice of breathing in how awful he must feel right then to have almost hit me.
Yes.
And that was a great day.
Yes,
good. And it was about fear and the boundary, not between me and him, but the connection.
Yes, very nice. The sense of fear is a very... we'll have to see its origin. When we're afraid... it's not the experience of the moment that we're afraid of. We're afraid of the extrapolation of where this experience is eventually going to go. We're afraid of what's going to become of us, not what is happening to us. And so you begin to see that since the sense of self depends upon conceptualization, that its strategies for protection also have to continue along the conceptual line. And that any governance of the here and now, any relationship with the here and now, takes away both the sense of self and the need to protect oneself from the feared object. both of which could only be maintained through the discourse, the inward discourse. So when we talk about fear in terms of the practice, the first thing we have to do is to feel the fear, make it conscious. Nothing can happen unless we become aware that we are afraid. Or if we're not aware, it stays conceptual. And the conceptual is believed. Why is it believed? Because it's not being paid attention to see that it's a conceptual model. It's only when you see that we're creating a conceptual world outside of this one that you can test the first whether that is true or not. In this moment, fear is never true. In this moment, now, not that I'm going to die soon, but now, when you are not dead. Is it true? It's where we ask that question. Mind, is it true? Well, you know, I've had a life where a lot of fears have come true. Not that. Here, in this moment, where the crosshairs of our coordinates meet. Here. The immediacy of here. Not the extrapolation of here. Here. Can't maintain itself. If we have the courage to ask, which is really one way of looking at everything we're doing in this class and all the other classes, is to give ourselves the courage to ask. To give ourselves the courage to get on the rocket, to get to the other. And that, you have to ask yourself some very important questions, even to want to go. And then the willingness to go, the full-hearted willingness to go, is the other landscape. It comes immediately. There's not a trip we have to take. If that were so, we would just be perpetuating the strategies from whence we have come. It's immediate. And we know ourselves for the first time. So we have to stop. I want to thank you all for your diligence.